This is Business Impact, a podcast series from UCD College of Business, Ireland's leading business school. I'm your host, Emmett Oliver, and each episode I'll be joined by world-renowned faculty from across the College of Business, as well as international industry leaders who'll offer us insight, spark curiosity, and challenge you to rethink how you do business in a changing world. Now, you're welcome back to Business Impact, and I am really looking forward to our next conversation. Not that I haven't to all the ones we have, but there's a slight sort of informal hierarchy, I suppose, of ones that you are very, very interested in and ones you're sort of interested in. But this is definitely in the former category. And back in July 2021, we talked to my guest, who will be introduced very shortly. It was an interesting conversation. Some people thought we were going to have a bit of a celebrity death match or something about cryptocurrencies at that time, but actually we had a very civilized and respectful conversation. And that guest was Paul Dylan Ennis, who is a lecturer here at the UCD School of Business, and he looks very closely, both lectures and research, in the area of alternative currencies, cryptocurrencies, Ethereum, which is one of the leading ones after Bitcoin. And he also looks a little bit at the political and social movement around these alternative assets. And when I talked to Paul, I suppose at that time, cryptocurrencies were still very much in the margins, very much anti-establishment in the financial community and in broader economic dialogue. But they have come more into the mainstream in a number of ways, which we'll pick through in our conversation. So we thought it would be a good idea, post-COVID, thankfully out of those dark days, we thought it would be an idea to bring Paul Dylan Ennis back in and bring us up to date where we are with the crypto movement. Again, this is a topic that drives strong reactions. Some people are big advocates of cryptocurrencies and don't like fiat currencies, and there's a whole debate around that. And then there's other people that absolutely think that cryptocurrencies are going to destabilize financial markets, that are a pyramid scheme. So there's strong views, let's say, held in this area. So Paul is very good at picking through them and giving us some nourishment on this whole area. Paul, you're very welcome back to the podcast.
Very excited to be back. Always interesting.
Well, listen, let's talk through where we are at the moment and maybe remind listeners a little bit about alternative assets and the philosophies around them. Is it fair for me to say that over the last few years, they've come in from the cold a little bit? There's a little bit more respectability in these assets. A lot of them now are bound up in exchange-traded funds and so on. There's even talk about them becoming part of mainstream pension planning structures and so on. So if you kind of look at the narrative of it, they've come in a little bit from the margins and they've come into the centre.
Yes. I wouldn't necessarily say it's, you know, the core of mainstream business or anything of that kind. But the times when I realized that it was really beginning to be normalized is when I started hearing people talk about it on News Talk.
So, okay.
whenever I was like listening to News Talk, driving in the morning, and they would talk about Bitcoin every so often, I was like, okay, this is now a topic that most people know about. So like, even if people don't have a deep understanding of what cryptocurrencies represent, they know about it. They've heard about it. They definitely know the name Bitcoin. They may not know Ethereum, or they may not know Solana, etc., but they've definitely heard of Bitcoin. And you can even see it in lots of TV shows. Every so often, there will be some kind of, if there's any kind of criminality, any kind of hackers, they're using Bitcoin. The main way that it's probably become to people's attention, in the finance world, it's definitely the ETFs. So Bitcoin and Ethereum representing the number one and number two assets, and probably the two assets that have the reasonable case to be ETFs, in that they're very long standing. They run in a very organized way, and there's a certain amount of trust in the sense of the people who are like maintaining Bitcoin and the people who are maintaining Ethereum to abandon those projects or something like that. So they have the Lindy effect associated with them. And then the other way that it's become normalized is through Trump would be one element of this. So prior to Trump's election, the Biden administration was a little bit hostile to crypto. There was a lot of cases against various different crypto projects by the Securities and Exchange Commission under Gary Gensler. And then with the Trump administration, it's the complete opposite. Basically, all the investigations are stopped. Trump has his strategic reserve of crypto assets. He has his own meme coin, so does Melania. And Doge, Elon has taken this, turned Department of Government Efficiency from Dogecoin, an early crypto that he's always been strongly associated with. So all the markings of something mainstream are there. At the same time, I wouldn't necessarily say that its reputation has improved in any sense. I think people are more familiar with it, but maybe not necessarily positively oriented toward it.
Now, as you say, the currencies have come right into the mainstream, into the White House. Like, you know, he will often talk about them at his press conferences, and you know, the Democratic Party, even at the end, were moving towards them as well. So it wasn't just one party. I remember Kamala Harris even making a speech that was less critical than maybe Joe Biden had. So they really have done that. And you see, Britain wants to become a crypto hub and so on. So do you think all of this is temporary, or do you think they're here to stay? Or do you, and I'm just going to put what the critics would say, that it's introducing a force of instability into the system that is going to explode at some point, that it's a bit like the subprime mortgages era. There's an asset that's been invited into the system. I suppose they would call it a kind of a virus being carried into the heart of the financial system. And it's only a matter of time before we find out that this wasn't a wise move. Or do you think they're just the traditional critics that are going to remain there? Or what's your whole assessment of how people are interpreting this coming into the center?
Kamala is a good example of recognizing maybe a little bit too late that crypto people are a constituency of sorts. So in her speech, they were appealing to the crypto sector to get a certain amount of backing. So he promised the Bitcoin community that he would free Ross Ulbricht, this early Bitcoin pioneer who had established the darknet marketplaces, was serving a double life sentence without the possibility of parole. And Trump, essentially, in exchange for the Bitcoin vote, said that he would free Ross Ulbricht, and he did about a week into his term. So that strategic Trump approach seems to have worked. And I suspect in the future, the Democrats will probably realize that even if you dislike what crypto represents, it nonetheless is something that generationally people are attracted to. It is a constituency of some sort. Many crypto people see themselves as single issue voters, as in the only thing that they care about. They're so alienated from the rest of mainstream politics that that's really the only thing that they're concerned with. So they'll vote Trump or whoever the future Democratic candidate is based on their attitudes toward crypto. And so on that front, whether it's a good or a bad thing is that's something we don't really know. We're really at that early stage, at least with the political side of it, where the actual implications or consequences are up in the air. In terms of the contagion and the idea that it's something which will, you know, we'll get a big short, but it's a crypto big short, maybe 10 years down the line. People have said that about crypto for a very, very long time. It's always on the precipice of collapsing. It's always on the precipice of destroying the traditional financial institutions. But I tend to see the crypto industry, especially at this point, where it's a little bit more mature. That might be hard for people to see from the outside, but they're much better organized. The major companies are more established. So let's say like in decentralized finance, the major companies with a dominance of, you know, 70%, like Aave, they wouldn't be too far away in terms of their mature organization than a traditional financial institution. So the core entities are fairly well run, and I wouldn't be exceptionally concerned about it. And there's also the stark reality that there's nothing you can really do about it. That's one of the interesting properties of crypto. It's like a permissionless technology, meaning that it's a network, so you can't shut it down in the same way you could shut down other local currencies, for example. So it's a global currency that exists on a network, and so to shut it down becomes, like, it's not a feasible a thing to do. So, yeah, it's possible, but I've heard too many people tell me that Bitcoin and Ethereum would destroy things or collapse for too many years for me to worry about at this point.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I mean, obviously, it could still happen. Bubbles do take a long time to build up, but I understand what you mean. There is a little bit of boy who cried wolf element going on. I suppose the other thing that's very intriguing is obviously the start of this decentralized currency movement was, the whole point of it was to be decentralized, to be away from power, to be an opponent of conventional traditional power. It was anti-establishment. That was literally the purpose of the asset. So is there a slight discomfort then that are sort of like sitting on Donald Trump's shoulder? They are the establishment. They are literally at the heart of power in the United States. You know, they have, as you said, BlackRock Asset Management, you know, and other sort of capitalist forces talking them up. Do you not think there's a slight issue there? There's a sort of a collision there where these rebels have sort of come in and they've kind of joined the establishment. They are literally part of the government. They are promoted by the current US government. So how do you think that will be reconciled? And has that alienated some people in the crypto movement? Are they all just happy to be at the top table and no one's really too concerned with no longer being anti-establishment? So I'm just trying to kind of marry those two things.
When you get into the nature of what crypto cultures are like, they're not really a monolith. So they are often discussed as in a monolithic sense. So people will say things like, you know, there's a commitment to decentralization. Now, the nature of that decentralization or anti-establishment aspect to it will depend on which cryptocurrency you're associated with. So if you're a Bitcoiner, especially in 2025, then you are inheriting this traditional cypherpunk view. So somebody who is trying to create a decentralized money or a money that's a non-state money. But if you're in 2025, things have evolved to such an extent that actually most Bitcoin culture is quite close to MAGA culture. It's very libertarian, very Americanized language of cowboys and stakes and all this kind of thing, like a very masculine sort of aesthetic. It is very, like, Bitcoin culture is very much immersed in that at this point. So you will still hear those traditional values and they still see themselves as anti-establishment, but more in a populist sense. So the Bitcoiner today is more likely to be opposed to the Democrats because they see the Democrats as part of the elites.
How long will that be sustainable if you're running the government, your Doge, you're like, it's going to become increasingly hard to be credible saying that.
Yeah, but they see themselves as aligned, like Trump and Doge, they see, in the same way Trump and Doge are a contradiction, where they're talking about overthrowing the kind of elites, but they are themselves the power. The same thing you'll find in a lot of Bitcoin culture. They maybe haven't quite realized just how powerful they are. In Ethereum culture, that's not present. So if you look at Ethereum or Solana, all these other chains, they don't have that same perspective. They're more suspicious, more critical of what they see as this co-opting of traditional crypto values, especially the collapsing of crypto values into American values, let's say. So the global aspect of it is something they see as being threatened. It's very similar if you've ever watched a speech from, say, Elon Musk in the White House talking about the Democratic elite, and you're kind of wondering, why are you complaining so much? You're in power. You're in the White House. You're literally sitting beside the president. I think there's a nice analogy there with the current situation in terms of cryptos. Claims to be anti-establishment while itself being very much embedded in the networks of the establishment at this point.
Yeah, the other thing that strikes me as quite curious, and I don't know, I doubt I'm the only one who have noticed this, I'm sure thousands of others have as well, is when the currencies started, Bitcoin in particular, came to prominence, they were sort of explaining their usefulness to the world as a medium of exchange, as a potential, like it was actually discussed as potentially supplanting fiat money. You know, you had the whole experiment in South America, in Venezuela, right? It was kind of like, and now you hear cryptocurrency advocates saying, oh, well, nobody ever expected that to happen. It's more of a financial investment or an inflation hedge or something. So it sort of seems like, and again, I don't want to be so too cynical, but it seems that sort of the first claim was kind of just junked. It was kind of thrown out and everyone sort of said, oh, well, that was a bit over the top. And we've kind of now gone back to the other one, which was just, it's an investment like gold or whatever, you know, it's just, it's kind of a solid, you know, you kind of diversify your risk type of thing, right? So I has the day of talking about it replacing the dollar or the euro or whatever, is that sort of over? Or was that never really, that was only a small minority that were ever making that claim? Or is that going to still be the long-term project? Like, so where does that fit into what people are saying? And again, I know your point about the monolith, etc., but if you could just address that point in some way, that the initial claim by some was to make it an alternative global currency that could compete with these massive fiat currencies. You don't hear much about that anymore. So is that project over, or was it never a real thing in the first place?
So Bitcoin is now 15 years old. So the original creator of Bitcoin, right, Satoshi Nakamoto, the white paper, it's Bitcoin, peer-to-peer electronic cash system. And he belongs to this rich history of trying to create a digital cash. And in that initial 5 years, so let's say 2009 to 2015, so maybe like 6 years, Nakamoto and that kind of community before Nakamoto disappears and hands it over, they're all very much part of this medium of exchange. It's going to be the currency. And then in the early history, even when Nakamoto leaves, that's primarily what people are interested in. So ATMs, coffee shops, et cetera, et cetera. But there is this large civil war that happens in 2015-16, where there's a group who eventually form what's called Bitcoin Cash, who argue that, you know, really Bitcoin is failing in its medium of exchange use case. And then there's the other side who begin to say that the volatility of Bitcoin clearly tells us that it's never really going to be used as the medium of exchange, at least not in the current system. And so it should be understood more as the digital gold, right? So that the digital gold people win, they win a war, like an actual civil war in the community. So it's not that they abandoned this idea, it's that there was a hard fought war over exactly what Bitcoin is, and the digital gold people won out on that. So the other side of this is that even in the digital gold world, they do believe that eventually Bitcoin becomes a global currency, but it's in a more futuristic sense. They call this hyper-Bitcoinization. So it's where the fiat economy collapses through its contradictions. So you could call this like the philosophy or the metaphysics of Bitcoin, and that eventually would transition over into a society that is purely Bitcoin based, but it's something for the future. And this is partially one of the reasons why they're happy to work with governments. They see themselves as Trojan horsing their way into governments. And I imagine, let's say 10 years from now, I wouldn't be surprised to see, you know, Bitcoiners pushing for these concepts of legal tender, like they've managed to do in El Salvador and other places.
Sorry, El Salvador, I think I said Venezuela, apologies. The other thing I suppose I might get, this might be out of your research area, but I'm sure you're interested in, is let's talk about how the establishment is responding, right? It's not all one way, right? As you say, the Bitcoiners got a big victory in November of last year with the presidential election. Obviously, other geographies, Britain or whatever, didn't go so well or whatever. You know, they didn't get their man in, so to speak, in other locations, right? But I do see the ECB and other establishment pillars, even the Federal Reserve, and as I mentioned, BlackRock Asset Management, the really kind of mainstream financial players. Some of them are co-opting the movement and saying you can invest in this, but then some of them are sort of you know, almost pushing them aside and saying, let's just come up with our own digital currency, like a digital euro or whatever. Now, you could say that's like a tribute to the Bitcoiners or the crypto movement, because they've had to sort of concede ground by saying this has a relevant use and utility. But equally, could you know, digital currencies just become sort of a bit like the Green Party? They could just have their clothes stolen by others, and they're just... Yes, they're in the mainstream, which is an achievement, but it'll be done by the mainstream. You know, it'll be Christine Lagarde will be coming out, you know, unveiling a digital euro or whatever. I mean, how do you see that? Is it almost like the establishment pushing back a little bit and coming up with their own narrative? Or what's your assessment of those kind of developments?
So this would be the stable coin kind of narrative. Yeah. Stable coin meaning just crypto asset, but it's pegged one-to-one with the dollar or to euros. And like stablecoins are not a small part of crypto. They make up a substantial amount of the activity. So if you go to like a daily volume, you'll see Tether and USDC. These are stablecoins that are created by companies. So they are not cryptos in the typical sense. If we think of like a decentralized community, which is running a currency. In the case of stablecoins, it's very often an exchange, a centralized exchange or a consortium of exchanges like with USDC. And these are actually backed by real dollars. Tether has like billions and billions of dollars of assets backing its stablecoin. Well, it's probably the easiest use case for people to understand, which is, okay, instead of having going through banks, right, I can just have a crypto asset that I can just move between wallets, and it's stable. It's corresponding to the real world dollar, the real world euro. And so it's very, very popular use case. Like in recent times, it's become a big story in crypto itself, as in the crypto community, which used to look at stable coins as a little bit of a boring narrative. It's exactly something that maybe the European Union might be pursuing. And it started to think, actually, this is a very strong, powerful position that we're in, that we have this head start against any future digital currency or stablecoin that's introduced by the EU. And there's been an acceleration to tempt people into using stablecoins in the crypto industry through things like, you know, offering interest and integrating into the decentralized finance ecosystem. Now, that being said, that's how the crypto people hope that it might play out. I expect like from the EU's perspective, and the EU is definitely more hostile to crypto than the US. To me, it's always made sense that we would transition over into something like a digital currency. I think that's an inevitability anyway, that all of our dollars and euros would eventually become into some kind of blockchain type system. I don't think that it would necessarily be a blockchain. I imagine it would be just directly controlled by the European Union, permissioned blockchain, I guess they would call it. I think that's just like a recognition or normalization of the cashless society. I think that's something that can't be avoided. And then it's up to crypto people to compete against that, to make their arguments that, okay, once you're in that completely digitized system, then you lose your privacy, etc. But whether those arguments play for, you know, the average Joe is always being crypto struggle. You know, that's where its radicalism really kicks in.
I want to get into meme coins in a few minutes, because that's a big part of our story. And I know you've been looking into that whole area. But before I move there, I just want to finally finish up on the sort of the reputation, you know, crypto as a brand type of questions. And obviously, the downfall of a Sam Bankman-Fried, you know, that probably brought a lot of attention, maybe unwanted, to the industry. And there's two interpretations of that event. And I'm not asking you to go in and talk about what happened in that particular company. But one interpretation was, look, this highlights that beneath the ideology and all the rest, this is a very disorganized, disordered world, you know, where corporate governance is poor, you know, and investors really should tread warily, you know, that when you actually look at how these organizations work, it's not a pretty picture. And, you know, his company was what happened there is uncovered in quite recent times. But then others sort of took it to interpretation, which is, look, this is the wheat being sorted out from the chaff. You know, the companies that Sandbank and Fried ran, you know, weren't ran well. And it's a good thing that, you know, the authorities caught up with them, and it cleans out some of the dysfunction out of the system, you know, and makes the crypto movement stronger at the end of it. You know, you take out the bad eggs, essentially, right? So just taking that event, like which one of those two interpretations are your own one, of course, would you take?
So the thing about FTX, which always fascinates me is, so I would say the authorities didn't really catch on to Sam Bankman-Fried. Most of that story was uncovered by CoinDesk, by journalists at CoinDesk, like crypto native media. His reputation amongst the authorities was pretty positive. Sam Bankman-Fried was, you know, going to the WEF. He was at Davos. He was on stage with Tony Blair and Bill Clinton, etc. Like, if any group was hoodwinked by FTX or by Sam Bankman-Fried in particular, it was the traditional financial world. The skepticism tended to be more on the crypto side. In terms of the disorganization on display at FTX, or Michael Lewis and other people covered this quite well, but like the level of like sociopathic tendencies in someone like Sam Bankman-Fried is probably like a once in a generational situation that could probably happen in any industry. But what made it very possible for him is that he courted the language of trying to clean up crypto. Like, that was his approach. That's how FTX succeeded. And the irony is that his argument was that most of the crypto industry is dysfunctional, but I'm the one who's going to offer you a safe place. I'm based in the US. I went to Stanford, all of these different things. So the hoodwinking that happened there, I think, was like definitely traumatic for the crypto industry. Yeah, the wheat from the chaff situation. Centralized exchanges for me are always the issue, because centralized exchanges are what tend to make the news. If you go to Netflix and you watch every documentary about crypto, it's always about an exchange. So the recent one about Bitfinex, this is where the rapper Razzle Khan and her boyfriend Ilya Liechtenstein, they broke into an exchange in 2016. So they have a Netflix documentary. Of course, there's many Sam Bankman-Fried documentaries. There's one about Jared Cotton from Quadriga CX, who faked his own death, possibly. He has a Netflix documentary. So these are what make it to the mainstream news, even though the centralized exchange is probably like the least representative aspect of crypto, of in terms of like what crypto is actually like. Because the centralized exchange is the bridge between the traditional financial world and the crypto world. It's not really part of crypto. It's just where most people are familiar with, because they buy their assets there. Yeah, so I find it like a point of frustration with exchanges. They're a necessary evil, I guess, because people need to use their fiat currency in order to enter crypto. But I do think people's relationships to them are still the same. So I don't get the sense that it's cleared out, like the exchanges have suddenly cleaned up. What seems to have happened is just that whatever exchanges currently exist now, so like the Coinbases, the Binances, these are the survivors for sure. And it's more the case that all the bad ones have simply collapsed over time. So all the shady operations have simply disappeared. Now, it's possible that Coinbase and Binance might collapse, But I'd probably, I'd say at this point, they've been around long enough. So something like Kraken, Coinbase, and Binance, these have now been around 10 plus years. I don't think you could really get away with a Sam Bankman-Fried type situation in 2025. I think people have been burned too much.
Well, let's hope that's the case. The other one I suppose we should talk about is there a paradox there where, you know, a lot of crypto champions want to go more mainstream? They want to spread this whole thing further, socialize it out, get the ordinary person. As I said, there is talk about pension investments going into these assets. Is the paradox now that if you want to do that, I'm not saying everyone wants to do that, but there's certainly a group that do, you then have to quite simply kind of give yourself over to greater regulation. Like if you're going to be taking the public's money, and what I mean by that is the mainstream, like, you know, whole chunks of society, ordinary consumers, they're sometimes called retail investors, you know, people who just have ordinary PAYE jobs, right? If you want them to hand over their money, the level of regulation that comes with that will increase because simply the public will not allow democratically these scandals to go on. They won't allow money to be frittered away. They will call upon the political establishment to do more, regulate more. So, you know, the crypto movement, they're getting into an area where they may have to choose. Equally, there are others, as you've pointed out, that will be happy to just become the giants of the game. So is there sort of are we coming to a moment where a fork in the road moment where the crypto movement, broadly speaking, will have to choose, do we want to kind of, you know, exchange a bit more regulation to get bigger, or we find the way we are and that this is kind of as big as we want to get? Because if we go any bigger than that, we'll just be another, we're just like a share or a bond or whatever. We're just sort of there we are, right? So do you think that moment has arrived, or do you think such a moment even exists in the first place?
And like no group of people in modern financial cultural times is more experienced with the nature of how regulation tends to operate, like the actual application of regulation, than crypto people. It's been like so many different attempts to either begin the process of regulation, so many different attempts to kind of crack down. And then also they've seen quite a bit, and I think this is an important point, is crypto people have seen the application of regulations and then the reneging on them. Like, so the recognition that what was done was wrong. So a good case of this would be Tornado Cash. So this was a mixer project. So you could like mix funds for privacy. They were sanctioned by the US government a few years ago. So a bunch of addresses associated with it went on the sanction list. And if you interacted with those addresses, then you could get in trouble. And then, you know, Trump gets elected and all of that just gets rescinded, right? So this is something that crypto people have seen. We've also got the pardons as well. And at the same time, you would have cases where some people are on trial for things in one country, like in the Netherlands, and then his co-developer in like the United States is not. So like this mess of regulations is something crypto people have become quite used to. And I think that their attitude toward it is more passive than people expect, because they've been so exposed and burned by it. They just don't know whether what's real or not. So when you say like if the community is looking at it like, well, we should get regulated because that would allow us to become more mainstream, the crypto community is more like, regulators sometimes come after us, sometimes they're not coming after us, sometimes they're saying we can do this, sometimes they're saying we can do that. So their attitude toward it is more, okay, whatever happens, happens. It's they feel themselves very much, don't try to understand the regulator because the regulator is always in two minds. So for example, another good example of this would be meme coins, which were judged to be fine. Like there's no regulation about them because there's no promise in meme coins of you know, anything serious beyond the meme itself. So that's like legitimate for now. But in 2 years, maybe that will change. So like trying to plan for regulations is, I think, something crypto people have learned not to do. Uniswap is a good example. It's a US-based company. It's one of the largest decentralized financial applications. So they're extremely compliant. Then they get an SEC investigation. So they spent years like trying to be compliant. They get an SEC investigation, and then the investigation is just dropped. So they don't know whether they're compliant or not. So they're in this Schrodinger's cat situation. And so I think crypto people have learned not to hyperfixate on it. So the retail or the average Joe person, I think at this point, most of the industry sees it as, it's good if retail turns up, it's good if the average Joe turns up, but they're not going to, they don't court it as much. I think they recognize it as like a subgenre of business or a minor sport in the overall industry. And maybe the ideal of, you know, going global and like expanding at that level has contracted a little bit. So maybe that's what they've learned from regulation, is not over promise, like, because that's what the regulators are probably fearing. You know, if everybody can do it, then they have to crack down.
You mentioned the meme coin. Would you be possible for, because I know a lot of listeners to this podcast will be crypto people or people who have strong opinions on the other side. A lot of people will just be maybe their first time listening and they know certain words or phrases. But can you walk us through meme coins? What are they? And maybe give us some examples, if that's okay.
Meme coins are a phenomenon that crypto has every so often. So NFTs would be the previous one that I think would have hit mainstream attention, where it's more focused on culture. It's not necessarily what most people associate with crypto, which is either payments or finance. So meme coins are definitely on the more fun spectrum, or at least that's how they're presented. They're very simple. They're simply images associated with a token. So there's nothing more complicated associated with it in the technical sense. And so in 2025, you can go into a website and it will just create you the meme coin on your behalf. So there are services now where if you want to launch projects, it's meme coins as a service, basically. So you just go to the website, you put in the name of it, you upload a picture. It will create the smart contract, so kind of like the program for you. And you don't have to think about it. And it will also create the market. And then that market will just go live on different websites. The most famous is Pump.Fun. Dex Screener would be another place where you would go and look at all the different markets. Yeah, they launch like straight away, and then there's a hype around them. When meme coins first emerged, there was definitely a sense of fairness around them. So in the beginning, they were very much starting as someone on social media had an idea, and then they would organically post one of these meme coins that would start a market. And then you would get these stories of people making, you know, huge amounts of money, very reminiscent of the early Bitcoin launches or Ethereum launches. Over time, however, they've tended to become very difficult for people to make money around, because there's organized groups which are launching the meme coins and keeping certain amounts for themselves, or sniping, as they call it. So they know what time the meme coin is going to launch, and so they're able to jump ahead of everybody else. And the major association that a lot of people have with them at this point is that it tends to be a very scammy aspect of it. It's definitely what I would consider like the one place when I show my students meme coins, it's the one place that they're the most familiar with. So most of them are interested in crypto. They're taking the class. They're familiar with meme coins, but they're also familiar with the fact that they're, you know, likely to just like extract money from you as quickly as possible. So yeah, it's a little bit of a new entry into the crypto world, where it's like hyper financialized. The culture associated with this is called degen, for degenerate, and it's typically associated with Solana as opposed to Bitcoin or Ethereum. And the main reason most people entering crypto today would hear about Solana is because of Pump.Fun and meme coins.
What about me and you, Paul, could create our own meme coin? What do you think?
This happens to me all the time. I get messages because I have a fairly, a mid-sized social media following, especially in the crypto industry. Like what they've done is they go into the history of the blockchain and they look at things that I did in the past and they say, could we build a meme coin around this? Like they're like analyzing influencers in order to find ways. And then
I don't know if that would suit a lot of us if it's going into the past, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Not sure we want to go back to our teenage years and create a coin on the basis of it, you know? Listen, fascinating conversation. I think we all of us can get a sense that there's probably several more podcasts worth in this. I know that a lot of people who listen to me in other places know I'm not a champion or cheerleader of cryptocurrencies at all, but I am prepared to have a dialogue, and I find what you're saying really interesting and fascinating, and I think you're quite balanced on both sides, which is you're a rare commodity at the moment. You know, there seems to be a Marmite and very binary the debate on this asset, but as you pointed out, it cannot be closed down technologically. So whether people like cryptocurrencies or not, they need to be covered. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation, Paul. It was the first one recorded in the white light of COVID, and was a very peculiar, surreal time. So this one's been a bit different. So we'll no doubt talk to you again. But for the moment, thank you for joining us on Business Impact.
Thank you.
Now, if you enjoyed this week's episode of the UCD Business Impact Podcast, please subscribe to episodes on Apple Podcast or Spotify. We cover a broad range of topics with insights from business leaders around the world, so there's sure to be something there for everyone. I'd like to thank our production team of Beth Gormley and Mike Liffey. They work tirelessly in the background, sourcing interviewees, editing, promoting episodes, and everything in between. I've been your host, Emmett Oliver, and we hope you can join us next time on UCD Business Impact.